nothing is any better just because it costs more. And I think that's a mistake that we've made in our society, is because is correlating cost with value and cost with return. And I guess you learn that because you see a ball player who gets $1 million who can't play. At $100,000, he would be stealing. And the fact is, you pay him $1 million doesn't make him that much better, and it doesn't mean that you've gotten that much greater return.
One ball, one strike, one out, one run. That kid at the bat, and the kid's what he done. Hit the ball in the bat, and the bat in the ball. You should have heard them fans all squall. It's going, it's going. This time it's really gone.
Say the baseball. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. It's our second annual opening day. We were preempted a couple weeks ago. Baseball special. We've got a great panel tonight. We're going to go around the room here. We have longtime Chicago author who's got two books out, George Castle. Thanks for coming in, George. Back from the dead, we've got Harry Carey. Hi, Harry.
Hello again, everybody. Great to be here.
Thank you. We got Chris Farrell from the Old Town School.
How you doing? Folkies.
Okay. My great friend Angelo Varius, my old Section 242 season partner. You got some Steve Goodman stories for us?
Hope so.
Okay. And Dan Long is going to jump in, too. Also has some baseball stuff. But let's start with George. George, you've done two books. One, we'll get to Jackie Robinson West in a little bit, but tell us about baseball's game changers. People do love lists. People like to rank things and stuff.
Well, this is going to be the first of a series of game changers for all the different sports, but I was asked by Lions Press to rank from 1 to 50 the top persons, innovations, and events change the game for better or for worse. So you had tremendous latitude. I could go to town on this, and you couldn't include everything you really needed.
So you have – how does this work? I mean, it's 5-4-3-2-1. I'm looking at it. Babe Ruth 1, Jackie Robinson 2. Tell us how you rank them and how you decided to do that. Well, and other panelists can jump in if they disagree with any of these.
Well, the book is meant to start arguments because you're not going to have the same 50, and none of the other guys here are going to have a 50. Babe Ruth changed the game with the snap of a fingers or a flick of the bat. It went from the dead ball era to the power era, and that is the way the game is played right now. He injected home runs in there instantaneously. Jackie slipped to number two reluctantly because even though he broke the color line, integration took 12 years to complete until the Red Sox integrated in 1959. Jackie almost belongs more to the world. He's like the first man to integrate a major American institution. And so he belongs to a much higher calling than just baseball.
I was intrigued with some Maury Wills and the stolen base. I think that's I think stolen base is kind of a lost art these days. You put that at 27.
Well, it brought in a new era in baseball that lasted about 20, 25 years in the early 60s because the stolen base had literally gone to a crawl. There would be guys leading the league with 20 or 30 steals before that, but Maury pushed it to a higher level, and a bunch of other guys stole 100 bases after that.
And we heard in the intro, we heard Bill Veeck. You've got William L. Veeck and Bill Veeck talk about their placement, 42 and 43.
Well, for all of you here who think that goats and curses and black cats have had something to do with the Cubs going 108 years without a World Series, the most catastrophic event in Cubs history was the early death of team president William L. Veeck. He had ownership power. He built up powerhouse teams in the late 20s and early 30s. And William L. Veeck had a bunch of innovations, such as radio, using radio at 7 radio stations carrying the Cubs, including this one, season tickets sold outside the ballpark. He had ownership power, fired Rogers Hornsby without clearing it with the owner. Had he lived to like 65, he might have groomed his son Bill Veeck to take over from him, and that would have prevented Phil Wrigley from coming in and meddling with the Cubs as he did, to disastrous effect, as we all know.
Yeah. Harry, Matt Wagner.
Yeah, Matt. How you doing, Dave? Great to be here. Cubs win the day 9-2. Best start in almost 50 years.
Harry, you weren't part of those starts. What happened?
What's that?
You weren't part of those starts, Harry. What happened?
Well, you know, I can only take so much credit. But anyway, but you know what? You can't be fun at the old ballpark, and it's going to be a fun year. I just wish Schwarber was going to be out there, too, every day.
Harry, how important was radio, you know, in getting, and I've been reading, there's a lot of talk this year about Vince Scully and stuff, just describing.
I never retired, by the way.
I know. <you're,
laughs> He's going to retire, but what a great guy, what a great voice. And, you know, the Dodgers, we always love to beat the Dodgers, though. And Tommy Lasorda, boy, oh boy. But all radio, I of course, on it, and it continued here on Radio 720 for me, doing, let's see, the innings 1, 2, 3, and 7, 8, 9, or if it went extras more than that on TV, but we did the middle innings on the radio. So I continued to do it very happily all through my career. Or maybe, I don't remember now the end of it, but but at least I know that, we had great announcers, too. Dwayne Stabs was on here and all these guys. And, of course, you know, Ron Sano and everybody. And Pat Hughes, boy, oh, boy, great, great people.
Now, Matt Wagner, who you really are.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
You worked here at GN, right,
Matt? Yeah, in 92. I was an intern, and it was a great time.
Now, you're a baseball fun. I mean, we've talked about this on our Golden Apple podcast,
right?
But your family's baseball fans. I mean, did you grow up listening to games on
radio?
Oh,
yeah.
Tell us about, for everybody, the magic of radio.
Well, yeah. I mean, like I said, listening to the WGN, and that was, you know, every day. The Cubs were on, and of course, so I enjoyed the shows on WGN too. But I was a GN listener, so yes, it was a theater. It's just, you know, you can't see it, but you're just kind of picturing it, and just the experience of listening on the radio is a lot of fun, you know, because you can just see everything, and you know, Harry was very funny, so it was, you know, and just like Ron Sano and Pat, you know.
And same question to you. I mean, did you listen on transistor radios and stuff? And
I
you're
did.
A Chicago guy.
In fact, George was, you know, as George was telling us everything we had to know about baseball in the green room before we started. I was telling him that I remember listening to the Koufax Perfect Game on a little transistor radio, and how I could never sleep after that. You know, I was trying to go to bed, little kid, trying to sleep, and then getting so excited over that game.
Speaking of that game, I actually have the tape of the Koufax post-game interview done with Dodgers announcer Jerry Doggett. The WGN and KFI crossed wires, and they carried, WGN carried the post-game interview, and somebody taped it in Galesburg. So that bit of rare broadcast history does exist in my files.
Yeah, I was reading today, actually, a story about Vince Scully, and they talked about the Aaron call, and they said Milo Hamilton had the whole call scripted out and stuff.
Yes,
and
he did.
And Vince Scully just waited for the moment and just ad-libbed it.
And then he paused.
The whole thing about listening to the crowd, you know. Yeah,
it was very impactful because he did say it was a socially significant call. A black man in the Deep South is getting a standing ovation. So Vin knew the profound nature of this home run.
Yeah, yeah. Other media things I'm interested in, just what this show is about, you have the decline of newspapers.
Well, we're both very, very, very well acquainted with that, Dave, but there is just the bulletin the other day, the Cleveland Plain Dealer will not staff all Indians road trips. And so a very good way we all grew up of reading the paper every day with the box scores and the game story and the sidebars and notes. It would take you inside the clubhouse, and with the newspapers cutting coverage, falling by the wayside, and not having any internet sites replace them one for one with the jobs lost, that is going to hurt the fans.
When did the book come out, and how can people find it?
Well, Baseball Game Changers came out in February. You can order it on Amazon.com. It's in all the major bookstores, whatever bookstores are left, same reason as newspapers. And if you are taking a flight, they are in the Hudson's newsstands, well-stocked in the airport, so you're looking for something to take on the plane.
You've got, now, one quibble I might have is you've got Michael Jordan, 36, playing baseball. All the great baseball moments.
No,
what
no,
about
no,
Common
I
Fan Zone?
No,
but, I mean,
gee,
you talk about how he introduced, I read it, you talked about, you brought
Ronnie
young kids.
Ronnie Wickers, I remember him chanting Fan Zone, who, Fan Zone, who, to 3,000 people in 1974 in September. Yeah, I'm glad you brought his name up. But I included Michael because, not because he had 202 in the Southern League,
right,
but because, like a Pied Piper, he lured African-American kids away from baseball to basketball. And Barry Bonds, who's twinned with Barry Bonds, or I should say with Michael Jordan in that ranking, because of his off-putting personality, most bizarre interview I ever did, July 30th, 1996, with Barry. Very, very paranoid of inferiority complex. He failed to be the role model to keep those kids in tow with baseball.
You really think Jordan resonated with baseball kids? You really think he did?
There were a lot.
I was down there in Birmingham. I went around.
This was not him playing baseball. He was such a magnificent character playing basketball, almost too good to be true. So everybody wanted to be like Mike, get his shoes. So African American kids were playing baseball in the 1980s, but by the 1990s, participation in the inner city had really gone down. It was a cause and effect with Michael.
We're going to be back with more on our baseball panel on WGN. Don't go away.
Tomorrow night is T Night, as Jim mentioned, WLUP Disco Demolition Night. I got a beautiful girl named Lorelei. Boy, that is a funny call letters for a station.
Whoop.
Sounds like you're swallowing. WLUP.
Whoop.
There's a ground ball foul on the third baseman.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on the 720 WGN. I didn't know you were going to play that, Dan. That's great.
I like to throw in a couple surprise cuts.
Yeah, that's very, very good. So that'll be our next book, Harry, July 12th. It's coming out, Disco Demolition, Oral History. What do you remember about that night, Harry?
Boy, oh boy, that was scary. Those people were crazy. I had to get out there and say, please stop, God, stop this now. I had to take over. But they didn't listen to you, Harry. I know, but I did. I got up there and did my thing. Like George said, you know, it's all on me, you know. That was crazy.
Lorelei, she's in the book. I tracked her down. She's out in L.A.
Well, she's a lovely lady.
George. Ball four is not on the list. I think ball four, it kind of goes in with decline of newspaper. But, I mean, ball four really kind of changed the whole landscape of the relationship between ball players and the media and stuff. Where do you rate ball four?
I probably left out some things that I should have included. You know, ball four was the first, really inside look, although Jim Brosnan's long season. Brosnan passed away a couple years ago, lives on the other side of Morton Grove for me, but... Yeah, that was a realistic look at the game, and it set the whole tone for really good inside baseball journalism from there on out. I really, really liked it. The other things that I left out were the huge stratospheric rise in ticket prices and the 1994 strike. But when you're doing 50, you're going to leave some out. You really need a list of 100 to really include everything that has merit.
I want to go around before we take a break for the news. We're talking about ball four. I just want to ask about baseball literature. Just around the panel, like your favorite baseball book, either when you were growing up or now. Brian, from the Supper Clubs, thanks for hanging around.
Yeah, absolutely.
I didn't know you were
didn't leave. They didn't. I snuck under the table.
And you had season seats where we are.
Yeah, right. Ange I was a couple rows behind you. I was the one throwing peanuts at you from behind.
So I wanted to take a swing at the baseball, just a baseball book thing.
I grew up in Michigan, so one of the first books I ever read was the Ron LaFleur story. Oh. I think I did a book report on that in fourth grade. So that's about as good as it gets as a fourth grader.
George, what's Ron LaFleur doing now? Do you know?
I really don't know what he's doing. He hasn't stayed in baseball.
He's in jail, isn't he?
Is he back
in jail? No.
No, I don't want to say that if it's not true. No,
okay.
I don't know that.
Well, maybe.
Ange?
I like that Warren Cromartie book about playing in Japan. I thought that was a really good book. You got to have Y?
That was ahead of the whole, before the Japan thing really exploded. That was one of the first.
I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's one that stands out a little
bit. He's real involved with trying to bring the baseball back to Montreal.
Yeah.
Cromartie is.
Well, good luck with that.
Chris?
Yeah. Well, my favorite use of baseball in literature, it's not quite the same as we're talking about, but it's in The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway. Here's Santiago, the Cuban fisherman, and he's out in the sea in this life and death struggle against the elements, against this great beast of a fish, and his inspiration was always the great DiMaggio. And Santiago's out there doing things that none of us could survive, and he's thinking, well, the great DiMaggio played with bone spurs, so I can do this. And I'm thinking about what would the great DiMaggio do in this moment? And it's just absolutely brilliant.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's
Ernest
good.
Hemingway. Yeah.
That's good. Harry, you must have read a lot with those glasses.
Yeah. Oh, you bet I did, you know. But the book that Bob Verdi wrote about me, that's a heck of a book. I like that one a lot.
Matt, what about your favorite book, Matt?
Well, a few years ago, I read a novel called The Art of Fielding, and that was really good. That was about a college baseball team. Interesting novel. It was a real good read.
Well, tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, it's been a few years since I read it, but I know I loved it. But it involves a player who either goes, I think it's a, he goes through a slump. Either it was either a hitting slump or it's a pitcher who, but he just loses all focus on how to do things. I mean, he just totally crashes and burns as a player, and actually he goes through a deep depression. But it's a very good novel, The Art of Fielding.
It must be a Cub book, right? Because
Bruce Rauner's out there looking at us. Matt, while we're talking about the Vex, you do work at Miller's Pub.
I do.
And do people
get Bill Vex Corner?
Do people talk? I mean, do people ask about that? Do people come in and ask who Bill Vex was? Do people know who Bill Vex was? And
sometimes people do ask. You know, yeah, and I answer it, you know, and it's right by the bar, so I bet our bartenders get asked frequently about it. That sign is right at the front of the bar of Miller's Pub.
You know, Roland Heeman can't make up the sleep that he lost at Miller's Pub, having to go with Bill after hours there, and Bill would hold court till the middle of the night. Then they'd all have to show up at 9 a.m., fresh the next day at Comiskey Park.
Yeah,
you gotta do what you gotta do.
We interviewed Paul Sullivan for the disco book in the corner. We brought him over there and took his portrait and stuff. Neat. So we're gonna take a break for the news, and we'll be back, and we're gonna talk about Steve Goodman in the bleachers. We're gonna play some music with Chris Farrell. Talk about Earl Pianchi. So don't go away on WGN.
The street lamps are on in Chicago tonight. And lovers are gazing at stars. The stores are all closing. Rom has been dozing. And the fat man is counting the cars. There's more cars than places to put them, he said. But I'll find room for some more. So round them up, boys, cause I want some more toys. Hit the lot by the grocery store. To me, way, hey, tow them away. The Lincoln Park Pirates are we. From Willamette to Gary, there's none that's so hairy. And we always collect our fee. To me, way. Hey, tow 'em away. We plunder the streets of your town. Be it Edsel or Chevy, there's no car too heavy, and no one can make us shut down. We break into cars when we gotta, with pickaxe and hammer and saw. They say this garage has no license, but little care I for the law. All my drivers are friendly and courteous. They're good manners you always will get. For they all are recent graduates of the charm school in Joliet. To me, way, hey, tow 'em away. The Lincoln Park Pirates are we. From Wilmette to Gary, there's none that's so hairy, and we always collect our fee. To me, way, hey, tow 'em away. We plunder the streets of your town. Be it Edsel or Chevy, there's no car too heavy, and no one can make us shut down. And when all the cars are collected, and all of the fenders are ruined, I'll tow all the boats in the Belmont Harbor to the Lincoln Park Lagoon. And when I've collected the ransom and sunk all the ones that won't yield, I'll tow all the planes that are blocking the runways at Midway, O'Hare, and Meigs Field. To me, way, hey, tow them away. The Lincoln Park Pirates are we. From Willamette to Gary, there's nothing so scary, and we always collect our fee. To Leeway, hey, tow 'em away. Now citizens gather around. I think it's enough. Let's call his bluff. Let's tow the bum out of town.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. And that's Chris Farrell doing the Steve Goodman song. Chris from the Old Town School. I was looking at Chris. You've been there since 1977?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I started working there as part of a performing group with Steve Levitt, Josh Frangel, Cindy Mangson, Mitch Thomas. We had a five-piece group, and we were actually on salary to go out and perform, and anything they wanted, we'd be there. And so I started that in 1976, so I just reached my 40 years at Old Town School.
Isn't that something? And for you coming, I mean, we wanted to point out, new class session begins on Monday, April 25th.
Yes.
Register at the Old Town School, dot.org, or over the phone, 773-728-6000 is what I have here.
Yeah,
but thank
you
for coming
down. We've been there since 1957.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's great.
Whoa, we're just about hitting 60. Whoa!
So, Ange, you played with
Steve
Goodman and Prine and stuff, but, I mean, there's over the years, there's so much, you know, fact and fiction on Steve, but you used to tell me stories about, like, would he bring a guitar into the bleachers? And
happened was I did a winter tour with Steve in 77, and that's when I met you, because we were out doing colleges in the Midwest, and I think we
I was at the dressing room door, like...
Yeah, trying to bribe your way in. But that summer, what happened in 77 was that was the Bill Madlock demanding a salary and getting traded by the Cubs, and they get Bobby Mercer as a replacement.
And they paid Mercer more than Madlock was asking for. If
5-year contract, right. So, and then they also hired Herman Franks, and everybody was like, oh, this is going to stink. And they started 77. They blew out the doors. They I think they were like almost 30 games over 500.
47 and 22 on June.
George, it's my turn.
Okay, I'm just giving you the
George, it's my turn. I have a story to tell.
please do.
So Stevie got all excited because everyone in the city was excited, as we were wont to do whenever the Cubs started out hot in May and June. We get all excited. And so he called a friend of mine, Bob Hoban, who lived pretty close to the park, and said, hey, why don't we all get instruments and let's go to the park and we can, you know, like we could do a thing. I think he was inspired a little by the Dodger Symphonies, you know, when they had that band in Dodger Stadium. On Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And so so Stevie came down and we met, and it was Stevie and his small size acoustic guitar, a pig nose amplifier. Bob Hoban had a fiddle. I couldn't bring a drum set in, so I had like a washboard and some thimbles on my hands. And Stevie's
I never knew it was this much. You went to this much.
And and Stevie had his daughter. It was Jesse with a big sign that you could tell that they had made that day. It was like a picture of Bobby Mercer in a rocking chair saying, "Go Bobby," because that was his big thing. He used to sit in a rocking chair and in the clubhouse. And so here we are walking into the bleachers. Could you imagine if we tried to do that now? We would have ended up in Guantanamo if we tried to do that in today's Wrigley Field. We get in the bleachers, right center field, sit down, get comfortable. Right around the first inning, Stevie starts playing in the break. I mean, he didn't play during the game, but he would play in the break. And he first played Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Second break, he does like... When the Cubs Come Marching In, and everybody's singing and getting into it, and the people from left field are looking over and saying, what's going on over there? We're having a party. It was great. And then about the third or fourth inning, there was a rain delay, and as you know, when there's rain delays in Wrigley Field, everybody in the bleachers gathers in these two wells, one in left field, one in right field. And so there was about maybe 700-800 people in the right field well, just standing there avoiding the rain. So Stevie goes up to there's a stairway leading up to the well. He's standing there. He's playing songs. He played Linkin Park Pirates. He played a couple other ones. People are cheering and screaming. It was just a fabulous day. And so the Cubs won. And so a couple weeks later, I got another call, and Stevie was coming down again. So we did the whole thing again, except a couple other people. Mike Jordan came, played harmonica, and Betsy Redhead was there. I don't know if he did it again after those two times, because he had to go out and make a living. I think he was out on the road most of the summer after that. But those were the two times I remember being in the bleachers with him.
What did he talk about with baseball? I mean, the Cubs. What was it? I mean, was he a big fan? Did he think about it as hope? I mean, what was his whole take on the Cubs? What did you guys talk about?
He was a big baseball fan. Yeah. Number one, he was a big baseball fan, because Al Benetta would always say that when they'd get in the rent-a-car at the airport and they'd be driving to the venue that they're playing that night, the thing he'd worry about the most was if they pass a ballpark, because Stevie would want to pull over and just watch two innings if it's a high school game or something. So, but he was a big baseball fan. But, I mean, I think he liked that sort of, the loser, the underdog sort of element. I mean, that's his whole life, you know, was like being an underdog, having to fight from – you know, fight for his life, fight for as long as he could. So I think that appealed to him. We had many times we were on the road, and, you know, Stevie would be the first one turning on a TV to find out what was going on with the Cubs.
Yeah. Now, did he talk to Earl much about baseball? Now, Earl, I know, is a Sox fan.
Oh, yeah.
I'd go to a few Sox games, and I'd go up on the upper deck, and there'd be Earl with a little cooler. Right. He'd sneak all his food in and stuff.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
But did Earl talk about baseball? Do you think Earl and Stevie talked about
sport? Here's the thing. Earl was not only
– tell us who Earl is. Earl Pianchi.
This is Earl Pianchi. He was the owner of the Earl of Old Town. He is the Earl of Old Town.
Where Steve...
It's the club at North and Wells that Steve Goodman started at, John Prine, Bonnie Kolak, and then a lot of national acts would come through. So, in fact, I remember... So there's a bit of tension there, because not only was Earl a White Sox fan, he did not like the Cubs. Because early on in my friendship with Earl, I made the mistake. I said something like, "Hey, Earl, you're going to the Cubs opener." He said, "I do not attend Wrigley Field." Yeah. And, oh, okay. I did. I had many a White Sox games with him, and it was the event. You know, it was the baseball game was one of them, one part of it. But, like, for example, you did the thing with the cooler and the picnic. Like, his sisters would make the sandwiches, and Viola would come with us.
And he lived in Pullman, right? I mean, I ran into him.
And then one afternoon, I got the Royal Schaller's treatment. You know, Schaller's pub.
Yeah.
And here's the deal. If you know Mr. Schaller, or you knew somebody, one of the regulars, you drive down Halsted Street. I think it's like 35th and Halsted. Right. Yeah. So you could park in Schaller's lot. You go in, have lunch, chicken soup, whatever. Then you walk over to the ballpark, and you leave your car there. And then you come back, and then you have another beer or a sandwich or something, and you go. So Earl was a buddy down there. So did the whole thing. We drove down there, had some lunch at Charlie's, and we walk across. And this was the grand promenade of Earl, because everybody knew him. He knew everybody. Now, Earl was about 6'2", long white hair, a big long white goatee, and he would just strut. The beautiful thing about Earl, when it was time to go to baseball game, that's all that matters. Yeah. Most important thing in the world. And we're walking.
Kind of like me.
Yeah, you got it. And we're walking across the street, and he comes to the corner and like a, "Oh, hey, where's the little dog? He's always barking at me." And, "Oh, he's in the back, and he gets nervous when there's too many people." "Oh, well, I'm sure he misses me. Tell him I love him, you know." And then we walk down the next one, and, "Hey, where's the hot dog stand that was here?" And they said, some guy said, "Oh, too many fees, licenses, you know, permits." Yeah, yeah. "Well, I'll talk to those guys, and I will straighten them out." And then you get to the ball game, and all the security guards knew him, and they're playing practical jokes on him. It was just this magnificent event.
Harry, before we take a break, Harry, isn't it great they kept "Go Cubs Go" for Steve Goodman?
Yeah, that's a great song. "Go Cubs Go, hey Chicago, what do you say? The Cubs are gonna win today and tomorrow and the next day."
Yeah, that's how it goes.
Sure have been hearing a lot of it this year.
Yeah. Okay, we're gonna be back after we're gonna talk some more George Castle and Jackie Robinson West after this on WGN.
Paper cups in the fence, and his knees were slightly bent. One hand pounding at his glove, one eye on the clouds above. Seven rows dropped their beers, and he turned and shifted gears. The ball began its quick descent.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. George, that's my brother.
Really?
Yeah, it's a song he did a long time ago, Doug, with a band called Bucket Number 6. You remember Bucket Number 6,
yeah.
Harry?
I remember Bucket Number 5.
You know, the ice cold bucket of Budweiser.
Yeah, he remembers Budweiser number
6. Number 1, number 6.
But, get your beer straight, Harry. Six. You had Grease a Dick and Falstaff, too, you know? Get your beer straight.
But
I don't think you could say what you said first on the radio, can you?
No, you six. Did 1946.
Anyway, it was a song called Andy Pafko's Shoestring Catch.
Oh,
very
great.
Nice song.
Yeah,
you should check it out.
Yeah.
It's on a compilation. So in the time we have left, tell me about Jackie Watt Robinson West. That's another book. You write a lot of books.
Yeah, 13. Yeah. Baker's Dozen. Well, no, Jackie Robinson West, I actually wrote that before Game Changers, starting soon after they won their Little League title and before they had the title stripped. But it isn't just a book on the team. It's a book on the backstory of that neighborhood, Washington Heights at 108th near Halstead, and about how people, if they're given an equal opportunity with everybody else, will have their lives turn out like everybody else. And without that, you couldn't have had baseball. People purged crime from their neighborhood, and it is a great parable for today with the violence on the South Side.
When did you start the book? Did you follow all the twists and turns? And you did give a little shout-out to Mark Conkle, who really stayed on that story. He really did.
He did.
He really did.
I wrote it in such a way that it was going to come out at least a year after the title anyway, so I didn't really focus on the twists and turns. The people who were running that program really screwed up. What happened is Little League threw these kids under the bus. They should have let the kids keep the title and then sanction the adults. The kids are not responsible for the adults' actions. They weren't responsible for fudging on their home addresses and all that. Also, it brought up the issue, guys, that Little League residency rules, that you have to play for your local Little League, that was formulated like 75 years ago in a more bucolic America. It doesn't apply to the inner city now. A kid who wants to play baseball will not want to play at its local park if there's gunfire there. He'll want to go two or three parks over where it's safer. Those Little League rules are outmoded, and I hope that even though it was a disaster for the program, it'll bring up some changes in that.
You have a section in the book I was reading, I just got it a couple days ago, where you talked to Lloyd McClendon about the Little League and Gary. And, I mean, there was a line, I think you interviewed him, or we talked, when you wanted to find kids, you knew where to find them. They were on the Little League field.
Well, there was a definite correlation in Lloyd McClendon's case to employed fathers when the steel mills were still running full in 1970 and baseball. And so the Jackie Robinson West kids broke the stereotypes that all the kids in the inner city are fatherless, they're rudderless, they just want to play basketball. Almost all of them have fathers, and baseball's passed along. It's a father-to-son type of game.
And where can people find your books, George?
Same place as Baseball Game Changers, online at Amazon.com and in major bookstores.
I want to go around the panel with one more question, but how's Casey doing? Do you still have Casey? It says you have a 23-year-old African gray parrot.
Yes, Casey is still going strong.
How old is Casey now?
Casey was born in 1993. She's 23 and sounds exactly like me. There's a mimic of George. Okay. One George is too many.
Okay. The Cubs are 9-2, still their best start since 1969. Mm-hmm. The Sox are 8-3. I don't know if that's still their best since 82. Around the horn real quick, do you guys think this will continue? How do you think this is going to play out? Brian?
Absolutely.
You were at the game today, too.
I was
right?
at the game today. Yeah, absolutely. It was fun watching Arrieta throw 95, 96 miles an hour with tilt. Yeah. I mean, as long as he stays on pace, he's our rock.
Yeah, yeah.
There's 1-4.
Yeah. Okay, Ange?
I think they'll make the playoffs. You know, anything after
the Cubs.
And the Cubs.
Yeah.
I think anything after that would be, you know, great. But I don't want to predict anything after that once you get in the playoffs. White Sox, who knows? I mean, you know, that's an up-and-down team, so you never know when all of a sudden somebody else is going to walk out and go to Thailand to do something
that's
wacky.
That's a crazy story. Here's your next song, Chris. Chris?
Okay. No, as an East Lakeview resident, I'm going all the way with this. Next year is here.
Okay. Harry, what do you think?
Holy cow. Every time I turn around, I'm saying the bases are loaded, and so am I. I'm telling you what, these guys can hit the ball, and you know what? With Schwarber, we'd probably win the rest of the games the whole year. No, I think it's going to be a heck of a year, and not to mention, can't forget the pitching, too. So you know what? I'm saying I'm very impressed with what I'm seeing so far.
Okay, George.
Well, enjoy the if you're a Cub fan, enjoy the journey. This is a great team full of homegrown young players. Do not get ahead of yourself and call a World Series right now. The playoffs are a trail of tears and an obstacle course. I think they'll make the playoffs, but I'm not going to call a World Series given that situation. White Sox should be in contention all year. They've got a much better camaraderie in the clubhouse.
Well, thank you. Thank you all for coming in. This was a lot of fun. Chris, you're going to play us out. Yeah. Tell us about the song you're going to play.
Yeah, this is a song about the old Negro Leagues. And this is before Jackie Robinson, when things were segregated. And this is for the great talent that just pretty much played too soon. My name is Randy Anderson. My age is way beyond the prime I knew in baseball shoes. My sporting days are gone. I'm just one more forgotten name among the brown-faced teams, an old dark horse who came the course they called the Negro League. I worked the fields of Tennessee and dreamed of better days. I left the plow, I left the field to join the homestead grays. All summer long we played the states, then headed south in fall. Through rain and dust we rode that bus so we could play baseball. We played for love, we played for pride, and seldom made much more. The bread and beans, the hotel bugs, the roads where fans don't roar. The all-night rides, the seedy sides came with the life we chose. But we made do and we came through, 'cause we knew we were pros. We played in shadows of the bay, Lou Gehrig and the rest. We stood outside the big league fence, so they were called the best. We played as well, we gave them hell in every hit and pitch. Then stood behind the color line and watched those men get rich. But did they see Josh Gibson swing or Satchel throw his stuff? And do you know how much it takes when best is not enough? When clouds roll in across the sky and hide the brightest moon, you'll often find some stars don't shine. Some men were born too soon. God bless you, Jackie Robinson, Willie Mays and all. You wore our numbers on your back when you played big league ball. And every time you hit one out, slid in or laid one down, you carried us from that old bus to the hall at Cooperstown. My name is Randy Anderson, you won't remember that. I'm just one more among the scores who played the ball and bat. Please, when you speak of heroes and you praise the great pastime, remember those forgotten pros, the stars that didn't shine.